Good afternoon and welcome. My name is Stacy Burnett, and I work with the ICANN's contractual compliance team, and I want to thank all of you for joining us this afternoon for a workshop to discuss the draft advisory concerning registrar best practices to protect registrants upon initiation of a UDRP complaint. We know you had many choices for workshops this afternoon, but we're glad you decided to fly with us. So I want to make sure this audience understands we have a very narrow focus today. We're really trying to focus on this draft document and solicit comments from our panelists and from you to determine if this document addresses some important issues. And so if you're here to talk about general amendments to the UDRP or just general gripes you've had with the UDRP, we're not going to turn you away, but we are going to try to get you to focus on this document. So I wanted to share some information with you. ICANN is interested in issuing a best practices document for registrars concerning the UDRP because we believe it's important to have an easy-to-read document upon initiation of a UDRP complaint. There are some registrars that don't have a legal team available to them. They're mom-and-pop shops, and they don't get these decisions coming to them frequently. And so there's a need to have an easy-to-read document that provides guidance. And so our goal today is to solicit comments from our panelists and from you regarding this working draft. And at the conclusion of the workshop, it's our aim to have some idea as to whether this document addresses some of the major challenges that providers, that IP attorneys, and registrars encounter upon initiation of a UDRP complaint. So without further delay, I want to introduce our esteemed panelists. And we asked all of them for one or two lines about their resume or giving us some background, and they all came back with these five-page curriculum vitaes. So we reduced them ourselves. Next to me is John Berryhill. John Berryhill is an intellectual property attorney based out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He's represented the registrar constituency in drafting this document. So we thank you for leading that effort, John. And he's represented claimants and respondents in more than 150 domain name dispute proceedings. He frequently advises registrars and registries in issues relating to the UDRP and intellectual property litigation. Next to John is J. Scott Evans. J. Scott Evans is Senior Legal Director of Global Brands and Trademarks at Yahoo, Incorporated. J. Scott served as a member of the five-member drafting team that drafted the original UDRP and rules of procedure for the UDRP. J. Scott has been actively involved in ICANN issues for over 10 years, even though he's only 21. So we have Daniel Roach Turner. Mr. Turner qualified as a solicitor in Australia following studies in economics and law at the University of Sydney. Before joining WIPO in 2006, he worked as executive officer in the intellectual property branch of the Australian Government Department of Communications and as a litigator in IP and enforcement at the Sydney offices of the law firm of Clayton Utz. We also have Alan Limberry. Mr. Limberry qualified as a barrister in England before immigrating to Australia in the 1960s, where he practiced as a litigator for many years in major law firms, specializing in intellectual property and competition law. In the late 1980s, he started mediating and turned full-time to mediation and arbitration in 1996. When he left his law firm to become managing director of his own dispute resolution consultancy, Strategic Resolution, he's a member of several domain name panels and has officiated in more than 300 domain name disputes. So I believe we have a great panel here today, and we're hoping to have a lively discussion. And I want to encourage members of the audience, if someone says something that sparks a thought in you, raise your hand. We want to get you involved as well. So before we turn to our panelists and start the discussion today, I want to turn the mic over to Khalil Rashid. He is ICANN's Contractual Compliance Audit Manager, and he's going to give you some information about how this document was developed and the next steps that are needed to finalize this draft document so that we all have a clear understanding as to where we're going.
Thanks, Stacey, and good afternoon, everyone. Again, my name is Khalil Rashid, and I serve as the ICANN Compliance Audit Manager. I hate to follow Stacey. I mean, she does so well and has the best openers. Before we go forward, I do want to thank the participants on the panel. I think it'd be harder to find a group of people with more in-depth knowledge about the EDRP, so I do thank you. The significant experience that they have and the help that they've provided in developing this draft thus far has been absolutely wonderful. So to sort of back up, let's just start with the idea for a registrar of best practices upon initiation of a UDRP complaint. What we did in the compliance department is assess trends in compliance. We generally do this from time to time to see where we could have the most efficacious efforts and to also develop our operating plan. And one of the things that we determined was that there was significant confusion and issue upon what happens upon initiation of a UDRP complaint. Several other issues with the UDRP as well, but that we figured was a good starting point because the verification process and the initiation of a complaint is actually at the beginning of the process. What the compliance department did in ICANN 33 was actually produce a draft document on registrar best practices. And we posted this document in Cairo to absolutely scathing reviews, rightfully so. We'd not gone to the registrar constituency and sought their expertise. And if you have an actual best practices, it has to be something that is actually practiced. The registrar constituency was very, very open to working with us. And since that time, has actually appointed a team of three members, some who are here, John Berryhill, who's actually on our panel. And we've made significant progress in developing a draft, that I think has come very far, in fact, I like to say. In addition, we also impaneled a team from the intellectual property constituency. We have a member here, J. Scott Evans, as well. So this isn't really an accident how this kind of came together. A number of our panelists have actually participated in the process in one way or the other. So we actually sought after developing the draft of the registrar constituency, we provided this to the intellectual property constituency for feedback and input, and as well as the providers. So at this next step, what we'd like to do is actually solicit your feedback here today. You guys kind of get to be on the ground floor and bring you behind the curtain into this process and actually have some say, after which we intend to actually publish this for public comment, pending further synthesis of the input that we've received from our participants and their relative constituencies. So with that said, what we wanted to actually do here was bring you behind the curtain, put you on the ground floor as to how some of this work goes on at ICANN, because it is an actual community. It's not staff solely driving these processes and documents, and give the panelists an opportunity to represent their various constituencies with respect to some of the more contentious issues that happen upon initiation of a UDRP complaint. So without further ado, at this point, I'll turn it over to Stacey Burnett, our moderator, and who will actually walk us through as the participants discuss some of the more contentious issues with this particular portion of the process.
Thank you, Khalil. So I wanted to ask all of our panelists to give us like a 3-minute summary of some of your experience with the UDRP over the years and whether you think a best practices document such as the one that's being proposed will be helpful. So we'll start with you, John. I'll get that going.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're so excited.
I heard my name and I woke up. I got scared because I was one of the scathing reviewers on the first draft of this document. And along with and being a scathing reviewer apparently earns one an invitation to help correct things that one perceives as wrong. And there is a tendency in almost any process to believe that if there's a process that requires cooperation between five different entities to do what any one of them perceives as the right thing, that if there are problems, it's necessarily arriving from the entity that is not yourself. And the issue that sort of suffuses many of the complaints about the UDRP is that while it defines a policy and a set of rules, it doesn't really define a set of internal processes for registrars. And UDRPs are rare events. While many of us in this room spend a lot of our time obsessing over UDRP disputes, there are 81 million names registered in .com, and WIPO reported somewhere on the order of 2,200 UDRPs last year, which works out to 0.03 of a percent of registered domain names in .com for which there was a UDRP dispute. Now, someone who's running a registrar can go along for years and hire staff that answer email, answer the phone, do support, and those support people can merrily go on their way for a long time without ever knowing what a UDRP is or hearing of a UDRP dispute or knowing what to do when they get what I call a ULO, a UDRP-like object that comes in to a registrar. Registrars receive an amazing amount of correspondence making legal claims or appearing to be some form of legal process. So one of the things that's coming up in the new registrar accreditation agreement is a training program for registrars in ICANN policy so that, you know, with accreditation, there will be, you know, a set of documents such as this that will define, you know, procedural steps that can be read by people who are actually running a registrar and not engaged in, you know, some philosophical inquiry into how the world should work, because registrars aren't run by lawyers. They're run by people who are, you know, can easily pick up a document that says, here are the steps that you should follow when you do something. The difficulty we get into there is that, by the same token, the registrars have, you know, clear obligations under the accreditation agreement and in the UDRP insofar as it's incorporated into that. So while there are gaps in procedures that registrars, you know, can or should follow, we did want to, in this document, sort of capture and describe things that registrars actually do in order to avoid running into situations where, you know, people start screaming the registrar is not doing what they're supposed to be doing when, you know, in fact, if you look at the UDRP, it doesn't really say the registrar shall do this and then do that. Now, of course, there are registrars that have procedures of their own that have been worked out over the years that work fine and smoothly and, you know, don't need this sort of document or don't necessarily need to follow the details of this document, just as the dispute providers such as WIPO have had to work out a number of gap-filling procedures. So while we didn't want this to be, you know, binding on registrars, we do recognize that there's a need within the registrar community for those who have not established a workable policy to have a roadmap to a suggested route to follow during a UDRP procedure that will avoid some of the more common problems where ICANN gets notified and Khalil gets notified and the UDRP provider you know, gets angry or frustrated all the way around.
Yeah, I agree, and I think a lot of what you said is exactly true. When the UDRP was drafted 10 years ago, there was one registrar, and that one registrar sat in the room and helped us draft the UDRP. So they knew exactly what they were doing, and they were solving an administrative nightmare that had occurred for them with regards to contentious litigation over domain names and a process they made up out of the ether. So as the market grew and became competitive, which was what ICANN did, I think you saw some tensions because you had people who got into the business that were not sophisticated, and it caused frustrations. And I think a document like this answers everyone's problems because it gives a resource to someone who is truly trying to run a business and do it well, and they have now a tool that will assist them, because you're right. Some registrars might not get something for 5 or 6 years, mm-hmm. just because they're only selling a very small amount of names. So I think that that's a very important thing to remember. Another thing this does is it assists ICANN in knowing that it's done as much as it can, and it separates the wheat from the chaff, correct? So that it identifies those who are absolutely bad actors because they aren't putting any processes in place, to those who are just small, unsophisticated registrars that are probably could one day turn into a very sophisticated registrar, but everybody starts somewhere. And also, I think there's a reality, at least in my world, because I sell keywords, I know that there are over-aggressive trademark attorneys, and there are over-aggressive parties that will try to fool parties that are naive because they perceive that something has value. So there are bad actors on both sides of the table, and having a document like this gives a clear pathway so everyone has an understanding of the playing field. So I'm 100% of supportive. We'll do anything we can to assist, to educate, and be involved in a process that does, because that's what this whole process is about, is coming up with solutions so that governments don't have to find solutions for us. And I think that this is a great idea.
David?
Yeah, I would echo all of those sentiments. I think as a provider, obviously, a very big part of what we do in administering disputes is having daily conversations with the almost 1,000 registrars that are out there today. And a lot of the time, in the majority of cases, those communications go very smoothly indeed, often because they have had extensive experience or perhaps even only limited experience in administering UDRP disputes. But there are, of course, occasions on which there is evidently a degree of lack of familiarity or understanding, and also, obviously, in some cases, bad actors. But putting those aside, I think that one of the great things about a document like this, even in the earlier form on which we commented previously, and we put some comments into ICANN on an earlier version of this draft with which we as a provider were very happy. We thought it was a very useful addition because it did coalesce many of the practical steps that registrars can helpfully take in responding to provider verification requests. And having now had the opportunity to look through this further revised draft, I would say that we see the utility of it magnified by several factors, not just because I think it replicates many of those essential questions in very user-friendly, accessible language, but it also deals, as John mentioned, with a number of matters of procedure that are not specified in the policy and the rules, but which are very practically useful both to filing parties and to respondents. For example, a number of providers, certainly WIPO, offers a procedure that's been in existence, J. Scott will correct me if I'm wrong here, since probably the early days, 2001, mm-hmm. around about, where there are only a handful of registrars in which parties who may want to settle a dispute may engage in communications and request a suspension from a provider that would then be granted for a limited period of time, and the registrar would then typically be instructed that they could unlock the domain name only for the purposes of implementing a settlement agreement. It's very heartening to see that procedure described with such precision and, I think, accessible language in the document. Another very helpful addition, I think, is the inclusion of an express reference to the language of the registration agreement. And this is important because, of course, the registration agreement typically is in the possession of the registrar, or at least a copy of it, and that determines either the language of the proceedings or at least triggers a question about whether or not the panel is going to exercise discretion to decide to proceed in a different language. And again, that's a matter in which WIPO has a procedure in which a party who is filing may submit a request that a different language be used. And it's very important for us to know the language of the registration agreement, to know whether or not we need to trigger an exercise or a consideration by the panel. And just to put some figures behind those, about 25% of the cases that we get, slightly less, about 23%, but a very significant proportion, in fact, suspend and settle. And so this is a very widely used mechanism. And in the case of language, we see language determinations needing to be made in almost 10% of our cases these days. So again, these are significant slices of the bread and butter cases that we see. Also, I think it's very useful that there's been some very helpful consideration, I think, of the question of lock in this paper. And I think that one of the big questions that hopefully we'll have some fruitful discussion about today is the question of how privacy and proxy registration services can be dealt with. Because certainly from WIPO's perspective, these are questions, and I heard, was it yesterday, Stacey, the ICANN study on the use of privacy and proxy registration services was suggesting from a sample of 550, was it, that there was something like 25% of the sampled registrations involving, is that correct?
25% of the sample, and I believe the sample is 2,400. Is William in the room?
Hi, so I'm William McKelligot with the compliance staff. So actually the number you allude to, 580, is the actual number of domains from the larger sample of 2,400 that appear to be registered with a privacy or proxy service,
okay.
The majority being under .com.
Right, okay. It's a very interesting statistic, and I raise it because we also did a little bit of looking at some of our own case numbers, and we found on a representative sample, our sample was slightly smaller. I think we did 270-odd cases over the space of a couple of years from 2008, and we took one in. We looked at the decided cases in particular, and we found that on decided cases we were getting privacy or proxy registration questions coming up in something like 10% of cases. So again, it's a significant chunk of the caseload that we see, and so it's very useful, I think, to see that the question of who is registration and the question of locking and when locking should occur has been addressed in this document. I think we could probably have some useful discussion about when exactly that might occur, but very, very useful, I think, indeed, to see it included. So I would give our wholehearted support to the process and look forward to continue being involved with it.
Alan?
Thank you. I'm really privileged to be here because I don't think you often hear from panelists, and I owe that to Tim Cole, I think, who somehow managed to wangle me in. From the panelists' point of view, the UDRP is the most wonderful, efficient, and economical way of overcoming the problems of multi-jurisdictional litigation. And from the panelists' point of view, a lot of the work is done by the time the file comes in, whether it's in hard copy or electronically, because the provider, acting as case manager, has done a great deal of the work. So a lot of the issues that might arise and be troubling perhaps to providers don't seem to trouble panelists as much. But the ones that do have thrown panelists generally into disarray, and the proxy privacy service issue is the current hot topic in that regard. Another one is delay in responding to provider requests for information, which from the panelist's point of view may be the subject of comment or criticism, but doesn't really tend to exercise the panelist's mind. However, when it comes to what I think is the most important issue from the panelists' point of view, I think there's still a bit of work to be done, and that is a change in the name of the registrant after filing of the complaint. And one reason why there is confusion about all this is the language of the policy. Clause 8 doesn't impose an obligation on the registrar. It simply says you, the registrant, may not transfer registration during a pending dispute. And in the very early days, long before proxy services were even thought of, panelists had to grapple with when does a dispute become pending? Because it doesn't commence until the provider's satisfied its obligations in terms of verification and notification to the respondent. In the meantime, the respondent has received a copy of the complaint at the same time as the complaint has been filed. So a quick-witted respondent can transfer the domain name to another registrant before even the formal commencement. And I was privileged to be the first to use the word cyber flying in a decision, although that was suggested to me by Eric Wilbers of WIPO, who denies that he ever did that, but I'd like to give him credit for it, where a registrant manages to transfer registration once the registrant becomes aware there's a complaint, but before being notified and formally served by the provider. And in about 2003, a panel decision, I think, definitively answered the question, when is a dispute pending, by saying a dispute is pending from the moment that it's filed, even before formal commencement. It's pending in the sense that it's waiting to be created. And there was reference made to dictionary meanings of the word pending. So long before proxy services even came along, panels were taking the view a dispute becomes pending as soon as it's filed. And registrars are made aware of a complaint being filed in two ways. First, all the providers' supplementary rules, except one, that's the Czech Arbitration Court, but I gather they're contemplating a possible amendment. They all require the complainant to send a copy of the complaint to the registrar at the same time as filing. So the registrar knows from having received a copy of the complaint that there is a complaint. Secondly, of course, a few days later, the provider seeks verification and requests registrar log. And I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit. It seems to me this draft currently contemplates registrars locking the register upon request from the provider. And that seems to me to be later than need be. It seems to me a more appropriate approach, in line with the definition of pending that panels have come up with, is that as soon as the registrar becomes aware of a complaint having been filed, the registrar should lock the domain name. And if there's any doubt about whether it's a legitimate complaint, just ask the provider who's mentioned in the complaint whether they have received a complaint or not. I better stop at that point because I'm getting a bit further ahead, I think, of what I was intended to do.
We like listening to you, though, Alan. What I'd like to do at this point is have our panel focus on three issues, and these three issues are issues that have been brought to the attention of ICANN by various parties, and we want to focus on whether these issues are addressed in this draft document, and if they are not, what we need to do to enhance the language to ensure that these issues are addressed. And so I want to start with David, because WIPO sent ICANN a letter in the last 18 months, and in that letter, WIPO expressed great concern because registrars allegedly are not responding to verification requests. And based on that letter to ICANN, the letter to our president, this was a huge concern, and it hampered your ability to process these complaints. And so I wanted to ask you, does this document address the issue concerning registrars' failure to respond to your verification request? And if it does not, what needs to be done to ensure that it does address that matter?
So I should just say, obviously, the reason why this is of such concern, or one of the many reasons why it is of concern, is because there is an obligation on a provider to notify a complaint to certain contact information to ensure that the registrant of the domain name does not, for example, have a transfer order rendered against them and lose the domain name without having had every fair opportunity to participate in the proceedings. And so one of the things that we usually ask registrars for is for the address of the billing information, which is not information that is typically made available in the publicly accessible WHOIS database. And so until we get that information from a registrar, there is always a risk that if we proceed with the notification, that notification may not be as fair or efficacious as it could have been if the registrar had given us the information that we asked for. And I should also say that in many cases, the majority, we get timely cooperative reactions from ICANN registrars across the spectrum, and we're very grateful for the time and the effort that registrars invest in cooperating with us in these verification processes. But having said that, there have been observed cases, of which there have been, I think, a regrettably large number that have accumulated over the course of the years about which we spoke in that letter, that we have noticed. So just to give you an example, for instance, if you or we did look at the last 225 cases, for example, that we sampled randomly since 2008, in which we administered about 3,000 cases, and we did a 1 in 10 sample of that. And we found that in those cases, there were approximately 24% of cases in which we needed to wait more than 2 days for a verification response. There were about 8% in which we needed to wait more than 7 days. And so obviously the longer the period of time we need to wait, the less expedited the procedure becomes. And that's problematic, not only from our perspective as a provider and our obligations under the rules, but also potentially from the registrant's perspective, because their domain name should, at least if the registrar's following best practice, be locked. So they lose the advantage of disposing of the domain name while the proceedings remain ongoing. So obviously it's in their interest and in the registrar's interest to try and have the proceedings resolved as quickly as possible. And so against that backdrop, we think it's very useful indeed that there is a best practice period of time being prescribed in this document, if only as an aspirational at this point, but very hopefully with a view to it establishing itself as something of a norm in time in the event that it's picked up through industry use by registrars. And we think that the 2-day period that it recommends is a very helpful and very healthy addition to the document. So we believe that that's effectively going to address the concerns that we raised in that letter, if indeed it is taken up by registrars.
Okay, so as I look at this document, verification is addressed in two places. Mm-hmm. One, under the title verification, if you go down on the document, Khalil, please. In verification, and then on page 3, where it instructs the registrar what to do when you receive a request from a provider. Is that sufficient? Do we need more? And anyone else on the panel, do you have any ideas as to whether this is enough concerning that particular issue?
There's something of a preliminary issue in that, and this will come up several times in the discussion. Some of the frequently recurring issues are communication problems, and it's not entirely clear that WIPO has been provided with a set of authoritative contacts by which they can notify registrars, and it's not entirely clear to registrars that they should maintain some sort of internal routing or designated contact for receiving those. And I think we had in one draft of this, and I think we still do, that the registrar should maintain a contact for receiving communications from authorized UDRP providers. And the difficulty is, and having filed UDRP complaints on behalf of complainants, is that there's not always clearly a way of finding the address where UDRPs come here. Sometimes things will be sent to support at the registrar's domain. This will go to a first level support person who is trying to identify whether or not this is a customer complaint about billing or something, and may become indeterminate, may be disposed of. You might send it to a Whois contact address for a registrar, and it will go to languish among inquiries from Nigerian widows. So in those instances, though, where registrars have been non-responsive and you contact ICANN, which maintains a system for authoritative contacts for registrars, has that generally resolved the problem in most instances, or does it just remain a hard core of non-responsive registrars?
I completely share the sentiment when it comes to the question of facilitating communication. I think that anything that can be done to make communication between providers and a specific point at a registrar more user-friendly is a very helpful addition.
Can you please try to use your microphone, because there are a lot of people that aren't even in this room listening, and it's not picking it up, I don't think.
Oh, right. Sorry, Tim. So yes, I think that's we tend to observe that where there are, this is an anecdotal observation, but typically where there is a single point of communication, UDRP at GoDaddy, domain disputes at register.com, whatever it may be, there tends to be a greater correlation between timely responses in those situations and circumstances in which all we have is a grab bag of email addresses, someone in a service centre, for example, someone's individual name, they might be on holidays, etc., etc. So I think that it's not only the case factually and anecdotally, but also I think it makes very good sense for registrars where they're able to maintain a single email address for UDRP disputes to do that. And I think it would also perhaps be useful for ICANN to give some consideration to perhaps maintaining a list. Certainly there's the information that's available on the Internic website, obviously, where registrars are required to keep contact data there, and that's very helpful, obviously. But, you know, it may be that registrars are not particularly partial to making UDRP dispute complaints available publicly. There may be considerations of this nature, but in any event, I think a single email address is a very helpful addition.
You know, I can just tell you, as having filed these things, sometimes, you know, living up to your obligation as a complainant to find out how to get it to the registrar. I mean, you're all over the site trying to find something, and there's a general legal one, but usually that's for legal issues other than the UDRP, which is not a legal issue with the registrar. It's just an administrative issue for them. So I think dedicated email addresses is a very bright idea. It clearly shows that it goes into a box that gets looked at, that doesn't necessarily, since it's to the providers, have to be publicly available, you know, so you can avoid a lot of the gaming of it that could occur. So I think it's a great idea, and it has someone who says, you check this every day. That's what you do. You check this every day. And I think that if you do, you will find. So I think it's a great idea. You know, one of the problems was when we started the system, the administrators of this system on the registrar level, many of them were not in the business of being speculators as well. So, you know, that has created a problem, because that's where the bad actors come in, because they are actually their own customers. And so they don't want the UDRP to work the way it's supposed to, because it breaks down their business model. Now, that's not every registrar. There, those that know that getting notice to the registrant is a customer service. You know, you want your customers to know what's happening with something they've entrusted you to do for them. Mm-hmm. So I think anything you can do to say to the good actors, this is going to increase efficiency, going to increase your decrease your confusion, and increase your ability to communicate effectively is a great idea.
While we're on page 3 of the draft, Item 4, the registrars asked for confirmation that the respondent named in the complaint is the registrant whose name and address appears in the registrar's Who Is database. And one of the critical issues that arises from a panelist's point of view, particularly in relation to proxy and privacy services, is what information should the registrar verify? Should the registrar verify the registration details at the date of the filing of the complaint, which is all that the complainant has to go on, so that the provider can tell whether or not the complaint is administratively compliant? Or should the registrar verify the changed information, if the information has changed since the filing of the complaint, or both? And until recently, and it may still be the practice, where there is a change, the provider tends to adopt the practice of going back to the complainant to say the registrar has verified that the details are different from what you have put in your complaint and invite the complainant to amend. And 9 times out of 10, the complainant amends without objection and the panelist doesn't need to concern himself or herself with it. But every now and again, a complainant objects and says, no, the person I named as the respondent was the person in whose name the domain name was registered as at the date of the filing of the complaint. I don't have to amend. Not only that, that is the proper respondent, not the customer of the proxy service, for example. So panelists have been grappling with this question, who is the proper respondent in circumstances like that? And have used all sorts of euphemisms, such as the underlying registrant, to refer to the customer of the proxy service in deciding, well, it's really the customer of the proxy service that's the proper respondent. And those terms gloss over the fact that the change in name of registrant is actually a transfer because the identity of the customer is different from the identity of the proxy service in whose name the domain name was registered at the time of the complaint. So you have this confusion amongst panelists as to whether the proper respondent is the proxy service or the customer or both. And you also have the difficulty that complainants are being asked to amend when maybe they don't have to. One of the most recent cases decided that provided the complaint names the registrant as at the date of the filing of the complaint, there is no need to amend, and it is compliant, even though it may be possible to treat the customer in whose name it now appears to be registered as the proper respondent. So with all of that going on, it may make sense for registrars to verify not simply the current details as at the date of the response to the provider, but also the details as at the date of the filing of the complaint, so as to be able to tell whether the complaint was administratively compliant or not. And that's just one small part of the kind of problem that comes up in relation to proxy services, at least from a panelist perspective.
What are some of the other panelists' ideas regarding amending this document to reflect what Alan just said?
Well, I think that one of the things that drives complainants up the wall is that whole process of, you know, if the WHOIS changes for whatever reason and the provider comes back. And in the case of WIPO, the provider will come back if the registrar has provided conflicting information with the original WHOIS information. WIPO will invite the complainant to amend it. And, you know, these sort of, if there is the appearance of procedural fun and games that have gone on prior to the case having reached a panel, this is why you know, only the wisest persons are selected to be panelists, because they can also make proper inferences upon the fun and games that are going on before them. But there are other UDRP providers that take a very structural approach and will require amendment of the UDRP complaint, and you know, you've got this situation where you have, you know, $400 an hour trademark attorneys that put this thing together and filed it, and here comes back, I've got to screw around with this beautiful package that I put together in PDF, and sometimes they're bound in several volumes, you know, and it drives the filing attorneys up the wall where. You know, this is an alternative dispute resolution process, and the panelists are granted, you know, plenary power, you know, to do lots of things. So, you know, whether or not the case is captioned a particular way, the procedural history up to the point of it reaching a panel is available to the panel, and the panel should exercise their you know, plenary powers to make those sorts of observations or even to recaption the case. Just, you know, one example, as a hobby, I follow a particular set of lawsuits in the United States that have been filed against the president, which the plaintiffs in these lawsuits believe that the president of the U.S. has any one of a number of different names They file and insist that that the case proceed in those names. But again, any court, any panel should be able to determine, well, you know, stepping back from formalities, who is behind this domain name, or do the circumstances suggest an evasion of responsibility itself suggestive of bad faith, upon which I can make an inference that regardless of who was named, this domain, should be transferred, because ultimately the order that issues from a UDRP is binding on the registrar. It's not a situation where a court has awarded that David pay me $500 and David must reach into his pocket and hand it to me. It's more of a situation where, Jay Scott is holding David's $500, and although the order is putatively against David, Jay Scott is going to implement the order. So if the name stays at one registrar, I believe it's useful to get panelist analysis and insight on, the dynamics of who the party should be and has what's gone on reflective of bad faith, or is it reflective of some administrative obligation, such as in relation to proxy services, that a provider of proxy services identify the party in interest. The other way of analyzing it is if you take a service, a very popular one, such as Domains by Proxy, which is a service provider that certain registrants can adopt, the UDRP permits a transfer as long as the receiving party has agreed to the terms of the UDRP, and built into the proxy service agreement that the customers sign on to with that service is that if there is a UDRP, you agree that the domain name shall be transferred to you. So it sort of falls into the category of permitted transfers under paragraph 8 of the UDRP in the typical proxy situation, which I see we've gotten onto proxies.
We have. And so I wanted to ask the panelists, do you think this document sufficiently, or does it address at all some of the privacy and proxy issues that arise at the initiation of a UDRP? Does it address privacy and proxy issues?
Yeah. It addresses them.
I think the answer to that is that in effect it does, if the intention in doing so is to allow for flexibility to modify between the filing of a complaint and the response to a provider verification. I think that particularly when you take into account the effect of 3.773 of the Registrar Accreditation Agreement, which does, I think, in its second part, allow for the modification in who is data where you have a licensee, and if you were to take the view that a privacy or proxy registration service was to be a licensor and that a quote-unquote underlying registrant was to be a licensee, and you were to have a best practice, for example, document that suggested that the domain name need only be locked at the time that the first verification request is received, then there is scope for registrars who may be, for example, themselves operating a privacy or proxy registration service to make a modification in the WHOIS database so that there is a change in or from privacy service X to Mr. Smith, the underlying registrant, provided that they did that in response to the verification request. But as to whether or not that's a desirable thing, I think that's a very different question. I think there is, perhaps as Alan suggests, some utility in at least considering whether or not it might be worth, as a matter of best practice, erring on the side of caution and locking the domain name on first notice of a complaint. Because obviously if you have, as you do, an obligation on the rules to forward a copy of the complaint to the respondent as a filing party, then it makes sense for a provider in their supplemental rules to also require that a copy be sent to the registrar at the same time or simultaneously, because otherwise you will get a time gap between the receipt of the complaint by the respondent, and if they are a
bad actor respondent and they seek to engage in cyber flying, their ability to do that is going to be enhanced as a result. And it's not as if, I think, if you were to impose a lock obligation on the first receipt of a complaint as a registrar, that would in any way preclude you, if you were also operating a privacy or proxy registration service, from saying to the provider, here is the person who I say has the beneficial interest in the domain name. Here is the person that engaged or contracted for the use of the privacy or proxy registration service. And that provider could then make that information available to the filing party. They would then have an opportunity to modify their complaint if they wished to do so. The panel would then have that information before them in determining who the appropriate named party in that case may be. The only difference is that you would not then have the change in the public who is. So that might be something that some consideration could be given to, perhaps.
I think one thing that this points out is, first of all, once again, when the UDRP was written, there were very few or no proxy services. Once again, there were not bad actors who themselves run proxy services. So we've come up with new problems that have to be addressed. I think that it just shows you the point of, when you focus on something like this, you need to look at all the tangential things that come into place. I think John's pointed out that there are some proxy services out there that have best practices. And I think that you may want to put that in and say, a best practice in this scenario would be this, and use off of it models we already know that work. Let's not reinvent the wheel. Let's use something that a legitimate business doing legitimate business works. And I think that should be in here. And another thing, with these contractual obligations, using numbers and things like this can be very, very confusing. Yes. For the small mom and pop shop.
Yep.
And you either need to excerpt that as an appendix to say those clauses are here attached, or something, because I think it gets very confusing and they see these numbers and it just gets all blurred. And what we're trying to do is make the coloring book version of how to do this, the really easy, simple, less complex.
If I may, just quickly add to that, I very much agree with that assessment, and I insofar as I think if there is going to be an approach, it should be a uniform approach, if it possibly can be. And if it can be addressed directly in the document so that people can see what is best practice, it should be done. I think if there's going to be an approach in which privacy and proxy registration services become part of the framework in which these disputes are dealt with, then it's very useful to have it done in a way that is transparent, that people can understand, and that everybody can sing from the same hymn sheet with. I think one of the big problems is that privacies and proxies have been, for I think a fairly long time, largely unconsidered. And I think it's very helpful and very healthy that there's now some discussion of them here in this particular context.
We had a question from the audience. If you could state your name and what company you're with, and then we'll hear some questions from the audience.
Sure. I'm Paul McGrady. I'm with Greenberg Traurig again, LexisNexis. Just have a question about the advisability of ICANN putting out a best practices for proxy services when proxy services and privacy services are not unique services that only an ICANN-accredited registrar can do. And in fact, I'm thinking about it more from the protection of the privacy or proxy services standpoint, because they could be lulled into a false sense of security and end up holding on to a hot potato that they may or may not want to hold on to in the event that something boils over to litigation. And so I understand the practical, it would be easier for the providers, but I'm wondering whether or not we are going down a path that we may not want to go down.
That's a good point, because every privacy or proxy service provider isn't a registrar. So that's a great point. Are there any other comments from the audience? Tim?
Yeah, Tim Cole with the Chief Registrar Liaison with ICANN. I just had one question. I'm surprised I haven't heard from anyone on the panel, but the talk of using the pending language as of the first filing, I think there has to be, if that's going to be included, then I think there also has to be some recognition of what is the other end of that. In other words, there have been many cases filed that have never gone to completion or may have not even gotten verified by the provider. And so it would concern me a little bit if a registrar was obligated or felt obligated to freeze and lock a name and then was never told that the case was withdrawn or something else, that name could be locked indefinitely to the detriment of the registrant.
Yeah, we reached some compromise language, and as it occurs to me now, as Jay said, there's some things that are bundled in here that are not obvious. And just on the who is point on page 3, where it says, you know, 3.773 of the RAA, yeah, that's where we refer to proxy services, and that needs to jump out in the coloring book version. Tim's point and Alan's point about, you know, this whole locking and when it should happen, we had quite a bit of discussion that reduced itself to a single sentence. And under the notification section on the first page, we said, upon notification of a dispute filed through a provider, the registrar should immediately place the name on registrar lock to prevent cancellation, transfer, and so forth. That actually says what we've been saying here is that when this ULO comes flying by the registrar, if the registrar, you know, again, notification, well, it could be sent to any email address or other contact at the registrar. But we wanted to capture the idea that the registrar should look at these ULOs, and is it CC'd to an ICANN approved dispute resolution provider? Because again, sometimes people will just send all sorts of fake looking legal documents. But if something comes in and it looks like a UDRP complaint and it's copied to domaindisputes@wipo.in, and if the registrar knows that that's the email address for domaindisputes@wipo.in, the registrar has some idea that, well, here's a ULO that I'm not going to analyze it. That's not my job. It appears to have some substance to it, and it's also going to a provider. But as Tim said, people can file these things repetitively and not pay the fees for the provider, and the registrar might not know when to unlock it. And then the next sentence, we said the registrar should receive a verification request from the provider. That is, I've seen something come by that has at least reached the attention of the person within the registrar organization who would be the one to act. It has the look and feel and smell of something that was filed through a UDRP provider. And then the next sentence is a pointer that if it really was one, I will shortly be receiving a communication from the UDRP provider, and if I don't hear anything soon, then I should either start asking questions or we'll hear from my customer that something funny's going on. So we did try to capture that idea, but we can't quite say, anytime you see some crazy piece of paper come flying in the door, you need to do harm to your customer, because that's another gateway to abuse.
I have a question, John. What's a reasonable time for the registrar to wait to receive the verification request from the dispute resolution provider? For a mom-and-pop shop who never receives these type notices, is 10 days, 20 days, 2 days? I mean, what would be reasonable?
For the UDRP provider response, the UDRP providers have been very concerned about this CyberFlight problem. And when the UDRP providers get one of these things, they consistently turn it around for a verification request within, 2 days or less. Sometimes it's less than 24 hours. Now, I will say also, though, and again, on what registrars know and don't know and the types of questions I get, I've had a registrar send me a verification request from the ADN DRC, which is an ICANN accredited dispute resolution provider, and the registrar sent me this email saying, I've been getting this stuff from China, and what is it? So that's sort of the level that we're working at. They don't even know that they're, who the accredited providers are. But again, in the new RAA, we have this notion of a training program to at least get those responsible and who weren't in the room with Jay 10 years ago to get this thing to work.
So do you think it's necessary to include some language that says if you don't get a verification request within, 10 days, that you should unlock that name?
I would make it shorter than 10 days.
Or
I mean,
some period of time.
Yes, but I do believe you need, it's a best practice. It's saying you don't have to do this, but boy, this is a good practice.
Right.
And so I would say, you know, yeah, I'd put a date in there. I'd say, you know, you're going to do this, you're going to lock it, but you should receive a verification reset in the event you haven't received by X date after receiving, you can unlock the name.
Right. Well, I would also say that the UDRP itself is broader than what we normally think of the administrative proceeding that's defined under it. The UDRP actually provides for what happens in the event of lawsuits as well.
Right.
It just, you know, skipping the UDRP administrative proceeding part of it. So a registrar may receive a civil complaint and not hear anything from anybody for, you know, 120 days till service. I believe that if a registrar takes action upon receiving a ULO that looks to be genuine and locks the name, and some registrars have funny interpretations of that, some of them will turn the name off, it is more likely that they will hear from the registrant if something's going on, and that may be the best gauge, because, you know, locking a name is not necessarily the worst thing that can happen to a domain registrant, and because the policy is designed to keep registrars out of trouble, I think they're capable of making pragmatic decisions between, you know, well, how long should I wait to hear back from the UDRP provider?
Alan?
I was just going to say, and I noticed Tim's managed to leave the room while his question is being answered, but it does seem to me that the moment the registrar becomes aware of a genuine or apparently genuine complaint, that's the moment to lock the domain name. If that does lead to some problems of the kind that Tim identified, the question is how to address those problems rather than to postpone the locking of the domain name.
Absolutely.
And I'd just like to come back on a point John made earlier. He was saying that 8A2 the policy, which allows a transfer during a pending dispute with the agreement of the registrant during a pending court proceeding or arbitration, that authorizes the registrar to change the registration details to reveal the name of the proxy services customer. That argument was made by domains by proxy in NAF claim 1226461 and was rejected by the panel, a three-member panel, which took the view that particular clause distinguishes between an administrative proceeding on the one hand and a court proceeding and an arbitration on the other, where by consent transfers may be permitted. So there are different views on that issue, and I think, funnily enough, even though he and I disagree on the interpretation of that, we may find ourselves in heated agreement on what might be a very neat solution to the whole question of proxy service registration, which maybe we need to come to.
And I think we'll come around to that. And, you know, paragraph 8A tries to address two things at once, and then the sentence picks up, and it's difficult to determine whether there's an authoritative interpretation, and this has gone back and forth with transfers during a UDRP for quite some time. But, you know, I would also suggest that there sometimes is a tendency to look for authoritative interpretations of the UDRP within the corpus of UDRP decisions. With respect to that panel, their position is well taken, but it is, you know, one UDRP decision among many.
I would just add to the observation about including a period after which the domain name would be unlocked if a verification request was not received from a provider by X date. While at a WIPO, I think we typically would, as John indicated, turn a complaint round in fairly short order, usually less than 24 hours, usually not more than 48. Certainly, there are always exceptional circumstances that can arise, And one of the things that we do try and do as part of maintaining our communications with registrars where we have difficulty getting a verification response back is that we have a three-phase process in which we will request them to again provide the information and in fact to do that again another two times before we will commence without it. If you are going to consider including a point after which the domain name should be unlocked, you may want to consider at least suggesting that the registrar, as a first step before doing so, at least contact the provider, just as a practical measure. But
that's a good suggestion. I think it was mentioned earlier by Alan that he wasn't particularly satisfied with the language in this draft document concerning the timing of the mechanism implemented to prevent cancellation or transfers, also known as locking. What about the other members of the panel? Are you satisfied with the language in this document and the timing in which locking is recommended for registrars?
I helped write it.
I know you agree with that.
I guess the only thing you might do is say upon any notification.
And where are you?
In under notification.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It says upon the notification. I would want to say upon any notification. So if you have this paperwork that looks like you're being informed, any how it comes in. You know, the notification sounds like notification is something that's defined, and is any notification just says if you know about this, this is what you have to do.
So if somebody gives you a phone call, hey,
I would say
we went through a lot of gyrations on this, but it is definitely an area where if you want to come up with magic language that doesn't sound, you know, official or sound like it's some sort of specific requirement, That allows that marginal exercise of subjective judgment as to whether or not this thing is for real. We definitely need that.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about first written?
Upon first written notification?
Is that email?
I would say that is email.
Be careful using the word written. I mean, someone's going to take that to mean it had to arrive in paper.
Well, you can say.
Put your
I think you can say first written, including
such
email.
As, such as is always nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Because when I file them, I send it by email. I send it by by either FedEx or registered mail. I mean, to everybody. Mm-hmm. I fax them. I mean, I get them to everybody by everything that the policy says you have to do, just in case there's a hiccup with any of the transmissions of data. Because I've had them. Right. Some of the bigger complaints, their smaller systems won't take them because the PDF's too big. It just gets caught.
Right. And again, to Alan's credit, you can tell a good-hearted person by their expectations of others' behavior. And because of the cyber flight problem, many complainants have adopted the practice of and not trusting the registrars either because they're in cahoots with the registrants, those nasty cyber squatters. They're all in bed together. It's quite frequent for complainants, you know, simply to file with the UDRP provider and then not to provide, you know, notice to the registrar or the registrant. And it's an understandable practice. When I file complaints, I send the complaint to the UDRP provider by the fastest available method and to the respondent by the slowest possible method, you know, simply to try to get that time lag. And I can count on David doing his job in 24 hours. But it is it's very hit or miss whether or not the registrar receives some communication. Quite often, the first communication that the registrar receives is some sort of request for correction that WIPO is sending to the complainant or the verification email is quite often, I'd say most of the time, the first time the registrar actually receives it. And again, when we're talking about notification, you know, someone's going to go marching into a courtroom with this document saying, you know, well, I sent it to postmaster@godaddy.com, which, you know, probably receives more email than we could imagine. And I, you know, these emails come. They're word attachments. So it's an email coming from someone you don't know with a large Microsoft product file attachment, okay, which sometimes in the file name, that'll be name.com dispute.doc, and that .com in the file name will trigger automated malware filters to delete that piece of email because .com might be an executable file. In fact, the National Arbitration Forum sends all of its documents that way, and I've tried to get them to stop. I've had to actually go to a different email provider because, you know, I've been practicing this for 10 years. My email provider will not send me emails that have attachments in the form of, you know, file names with .com in them. So people will believe a registrar has notice of something, but, you know, as we list ways or things that a registrar might have notice of, we want to make sure that it's, you know, a matter of actual notice, so that this then is not used as yet a reason to do to registrars what the UDRP was designed to avoid.
Well, we only have 15 minutes left, and I want to give the audience an opportunity to express concerns about this document or whether you agree with some of the statements that have been made earlier. Just share with us some of your thoughts concerning the draft document. I think we have one question. If you could state your name and your affiliation, please, sir.
Yes. Peter Infort from FICPI, the International Federation of Intellectual Property Attorneys. Someone said that this document is perhaps most suitable for unexperienced registrars. I would like to go back to clause number one, the confirmation that the domain names identified in a complaint are registered through the registrar. That seems to be easy enough, but I have, as a panelist, seen some registrars that were definitely not unexperienced, that couldn't identify an IDN. So they saw that in their WHOIS, the domain name was actually registered with some ASCII signs, and it was identified with their IDN version in the complaint. And with expected number of new TLDs and even more new IDN domain names, I think there must be some clarification in this point that I haven't the clear suggestion yet, but in case of an IDN, it's also identify its ASCII version or equivalent or something like that.
That's a fantastic suggestion. And right, expecting a U.S. registrar to recognize a Chinese character as opposed to the ASCII version, that's a fantastic suggestion.
Are there any other comments?
Just that this document doesn't seem to deal with post-decision obligations, and it's not intended to? Okay.
And WHOIS is going.
No.
Yeah.
That's next day. Right. It's our plan to issue future advisories regarding the UDRP. So this is just the first of a series that we expect to be published in the coming, I don't want to say months, but in the future.
and actually, Paul, what we've done is we have built in certain things that will dovetail with the post-decision practices. One of the things that comes up at the end of a UDRP dispute, if a name is ordered transferred, the registrar then starts receiving communications from people claiming that they are the ones to whom it should be transferred. It may be the complainant's attorney. It may be their client's IT people. And one of the things that we wanted to put in here, sort of inferentially, is that the registrar should, when the UDRP is commenced, capture, in connection with that dispute, who is the complainant's authorized representative, so that at the tail end, the registrar knows with whom it is they should be communicating about the transfer. So we've sort of preloaded this to dovetail with things that will probably be very helpful in the post-UDRP context.
I don't want to trespass on audience time, but I have a suggestion about how registrants who want to protect their privacy might better register their names, which would get over many of these problems. And since registrars appear to be either themselves or through affiliates frequently involved in proxy registrations, it might be worth mentioning. And that is that at the very beginning, the initial registration be, quote, name of privacy service, customer number so-and-so. And that would clearly convey that the registrant is not the proxy service. And the proxy service would never be respondent, so the panels wouldn't have to grapple with this question of who the proper respondent is. So I think registrars affiliated with proxy services might be encouraged, either in this document or otherwise, to themselves encourage this approach. Complainants would then be obliged to bring separate complaints against each customer instead of 20 complaints against the proxy service, as has happened in many cases. And that would provide the appropriate fees to the providers and relieve panelists of having to resolve 20 complaints in one. And there wouldn't be any need for a change in registrant following the filing. And if there were an unmasking of the customer, it wouldn't amount to a transfer because it's the same person simply revealing what their true name is. So that would solve that problem as well. And the customer could be given a choice as to whether or not they would like their true identity to be released, and that might be helpful to them if they want to defend themselves on legitimacy by showing that they're commonly known by their real name. And it would also give the customer an opportunity. We haven't spoken about mutual jurisdiction. There's a recent case that held that because the customer had not chosen the location of the registrar as one of the alternative mutual jurisdictions, in that particular case, it was the location of the privacy service in which the name had originally been registered, because the words at the time of the filing are relevant to the definition of mutual jurisdiction. So registering in the name customer number so-and-so gives the customer the opportunity to give, for example, a post office box in their home jurisdiction, thereby choosing their jurisdiction and not simply leaving it to that of the proxy service.
Are there any audience?
Thanks, Stacey. James Bladel from GoDaddy. As John will certainly attest, I'm not the UDRP is sort of outside my the boundaries of my area of expertise, but I did have a couple of questions. First, that I don't think that suggestion that you just made would be a one-size-fits-all approach because the different proxy services or privacy services are designed to behave very differently. I think that some cases could conceivably be closer to David's licensee, licensor model as well. But I did have a question, and I realize it might slightly be beyond the scope of this discussion, but what efforts are being undertaken by ICANN or the providers, if any, to ensure some degree of consistency or predictability, not in process or outcome, but in communication between the different providers? Now, we are a very large registrar, and we deal with all of the providers. And I think that it is becoming more art than science in knowing how to respond and how to interface with the different communications from each provider. So what can be done an advisory from ICANN or in between a collaboration between the different providers to get some consistency from the upstream dispute resolution providers.
You know, I think that's a wonderful point. And as we've undertaken this work, one of the things that we've suggested also is a provider best practices. We think that might be helpful and provide uniformity and consistency in the process as well. So many things came up as we undertook this work. One thing that was mentioned was the idea of UDRP designated contacts for registrars and the maintenance of a database for such information. So the point is well taken, and it's actually something we're looking to build upon in our next round of work on UDRP compliance. So in the future, you'll see several things coming down. One will be a post-implementation UDRP advisory, as well as a provider best practices as well.
And I would also say, James, that again, because this was the registrar best practice document, and I should point out that Ms. Lori Anderson of GoDaddy's legal department was one of three registrar representatives that contributed yeoman effort to this. But this document to the registrars saying, well, here's how things should go, implies that the UDRP providers will be playing the other side of this this musical instrument. That is that they will send a verification request requesting this information, or that communicate about commencement or suspension. But if a UDRP provider arguably is not doing something that looks familiar from the context of this to a registrar, then this does not seem to provide adequate guidance to that registrar, and they may wander off on their own roadmap.
And John, with the potential of you being on the other side of the table, I'd like something a little more than implies. Okay, no, I agree. And again, we're just looking for some guidelines as well. I appreciate though that this is a roadmap that could be turned inside out and read from behind, and it then becomes a provider recipe as well. So, thanks.
So James, when we develop the best practices draft for providers, we hope you'll participate and comment on that document.
Oh, absolutely not. Very I will good. Get someone qualified from within GoDaddy to participate in that. But Lori and Camille, and I think a lot of other folks I know worked very hard with that group here. But I'm here to represent their work.
Okay, great. Well, I think we're going to have to end. 30 seconds.
I think it's a very helpful question, a very helpful suggestion. My only comment would be, that I think it is very likely that what we will see here is a roadmap that does turn flip side, but I think that it would be very useful with limited resources that perhaps we focus on getting the registrar side of things done and wrapped and finished as a package before we start splitting the resources that we've got available and work with that perhaps as a benchmark for the next phase on providers. But yeah. Just a thought.
That would also be a useful vehicle for publishing many of the unpublished and informal procedures that WIPO's worked out over the years, many of which I think provide a model for all of the UDRP providers to certain extent. But
we're going to cut John off. Alan's going to get 10 seconds, and then we're going to close.
Less than 10. I've produced a short paper which has got all the cases on which I've been relying for making the points that I've been making, which you could get either from Khalil or from me at strategic-resolution.com.
Okay, so I want to thank all of our guests. This was a great discussion. This is not the end. This is just like the middle point. And again, Khalil, can you just summarize in like 20 seconds what the next steps are so everyone here can keep up with this progress?
Definitely. Again, what we like to do is synthesize not only the comments that were made today, but the further input to which we plan to receive from the providers as well as the intellectual property constituency. After that synthesis or that process, we plan to post the document for public comment, ideally before the Seoul ICANN 36 meeting. I think it's ICANN 36. But before the Seoul meeting, at which time the public will have the opportunity to provide input and further comment for other representatives as well. I am available. My email is, I have cards here, and I'll make my email available as well for not only for Alan's paper, but general questions and conclusions and sort of progress on the particular document. Again, I want to thank everyone who's participated both in today's session as well as on the panel. I guess I just really need to say how much we appreciate what you've done, because we've had so much concern and issue regarding the UDRP, and for such a group of divergent interest at times to come together and work this out is very much appreciated by the organization. So thank you.
Thanks, everybody.